Hi everyone, welcome back after the holiday break to the Introduction to Modern Cryptography lecture. The last week before the holidays, we looked at prime order groups just to wrap up these foundations with some minor or major mistakes. We looked at public key encryption, especially the definitions of public key encryption and the definitions of key encapsulation mechanisms, because key encapsulation mechanisms are simpler to build and more useful, especially if we want to build public key encryption in a hybrid fashion. Just a reminder what hybrid public key encryption means. We build public key encryption in a form such that we first encapsulate a symmetric key to the public key of the receiver, and then we use this symmetric key to encrypt our message with a symmetric encryption scheme. The result of that is that using the symmetric encryption scheme, we can very efficiently encrypt very long messages, and the asymmetric cryptography part, so the CEN part, can just encapsulate a short random symmetric key. So CEMs are the fundamental building block for building public key encryption, and we started looking at the El-Gamal CEM at the end of the last lecture before the holidays. We will continue today with digging deeper into how the El-Gamal CEM looks like. We won't find far much more details compared to the last week before the holidays. We will then look at a RSA-based key encapsulation mechanism. We have seen RSA in the context of signatures before. Today we will see it in the context of CEMs. So before it was about providing authenticity and integrity, and if we slightly modify the construction, we also actually get something to protect the confidentiality of keys. But this is very special, and this is important to remember, this is very special to RSA. So not every encryption or not every CEM can be turned into a signature scheme and vice versa. This is just very specific to RSA. And then, towards the end of today's lecture, we will look at the so-called Fujisaki-Okamoto transform, FO transform. The Fujisaki-Okamoto transform helps us to build something or to derive something for hybrid public key encryption. Namely, we will today mainly look at CEMs that provide weak security guarantees in the form of IND-CPA security, so only chosen plaintext attack security. The Fujisaki-Okamoto transform allows us to turn every IND-CPA secure scheme into an IND-CCA secure scheme. So we can strengthen the construction such that if it before was only secure against chosen plaintext attacks, it is now also secure against chosen ciphertext attacks. If you don't remember exactly what those two types of attacks were, you should start writing your cheat sheet. Probably towards the end of this lecture or the beginning of next lecture, we will then start looking at quantum adversaries and just very, very, very briefly and very shortly try to understand what Shor's algorithm is and how it helps a quantum attacker to break the security of the El-Gamal CEM or the RSA CEM. And this motivates us then to start next week with, I would say, the most complicated part of this lecture, which is a post-quantum secure key encapsulation mechanism. But this is just then a very short peak of high, high complexity. I will try to split it and make it digestible in very small intuitive chunks. And then after that, I hope we all can breathe and relax and try to understand the rest of this lecture. All right. Now, we start with repeating what the El-Gamal CEM was. Invented or discovered in 1985, so 9 years after the Diffie-Hellman key exchange was published, Tahir El-Gamal discovered that using the Diffie-Hellman key exchange, one can assign Alice a particular role and Bob a particular role, and then we can turn this non-interactive key exchange into a CEM. So, a reminder, what was the Diffie-Hellman key exchange? Alice and Bob, they both sample exponents x and y. They share the corresponding group elements, g to the x and g to the y, with each other. And then they compute a key, which is computed as g to the xy on both sides. And so they share a key. And based on the decision of Diffie-Hellman assumption, it is hard for an attacker to distinguish this key from a random group element g to the z. Now we want to build a chem from that. So we consider the g to the x of Alice as her public key, and we consider g to the y as the ciphertext that Bob sends to Alice. Now, the system-wide parameters in this setting is the description of the group, which consists of the generator g and the prime p. And then when Alice generates a key pair, she first samples the exponent x, assigns this exponent x to be this secret key, her secret decapsulation key, and she produces the public key by raising the generator to the power of x. She publishes the public key such that then Bob can encapsulate symmetric keys to her. The idea of encapsulating keys to Alice is that some user Bob again samples some y as the exponent from ZP prime. And then Bob uses the public key and raises it to the power of this exponent y and puts this into a smoothing function, for example, a hash function or a special extractor or something. We will see why this is relevant in a couple of seconds. And the output of this function h on input of pk to the y is the key that is encapsulated to Alice. The ciphertext that Bob then sends to Alice is g to the y. And then when Alice receives this ciphertext, she will just compute c to the sk, where sk is her exponent and c is g to the y, which is basically the key that Alice and Bob share, which is again fed into this type of smoothing function. And we have seen last week at the end of the lecture already that correctness is preserved because c to the sk is the same as g to the y to the sk, which is the same as g to the y times sk, which is the same as g to the sk to the y, which is pk to the y, which is what we input to the smoothing function on encapsulation. All right, this was just a very quick summary of what we have seen right before Christmas. Yes, please. A slightly different notation, because in the Diffie-Hellman key exchange you will also use a smoothing function at the end. Depends on your definition of what the NIKE should provide, but at the end you will also use some form of this H. Yes. And the reason for using this form of H, so choice of H. So does anybody have an idea of why we use this H? Maybe first the question, what property do we want to hold for a chem? What was the security requirements that we were aiming for? Does anybody remember what type of security definition we had for key encapsulation mechanisms? Okay, this is the moment to wake up for everybody. Yes, please.
Same as we had for symmetric encryption, so one-way method
and key
security.
Okay, with what type of attacker threats, threat models, what type of adversarial capabilities?
Both, like CPI and
CCI. Okay, very good. So we now know, we remember the name, first of all. We know we want something like IND CPA security, and this is what we want here. IND CPA security, what does that really mean? So what does... what can the attacker do, and what does the attacker ask to do to be successful? IND CPA security for chems. Yes, please.
IND means he's given to and he queries two messages to the oracle.
Okay. This is the problem. We're now talking about chems. So there are no messages here. Yes, please.
So Jaga gets an oracle to have keys, arbitrary keys encapsulated. And in the challenge, the attacker poses two keys and receives an encapsulation in return.
The problem is that our encapsulation algorithm doesn't take any input besides the public key. So this is very important for everybody now. I don't ask you to say something if you don't raise your hand. So you can look either up or into your notes, but you have to pay attention now because that's important until the end of today's lecture. So our IND games, or all of our games, all of our types of public key primitive games, start with the attacker receiving the public key of the attacked instance. So the attacker first receives a public key. Then the attacker can do with the public key whatever they want to do. So they can execute encapsulations to this public key themselves. In the setting that we look at the moment, CPA security, the attacker can only ask for challenges. The attacker cannot query anything regarding the decapsulation here. So how does a challenge look like? Perfect. Thank you so much for checking it out, looking it up, and understanding it. So the idea is the attacker sees a real ciphertext produced for the victim's public key, and the attacker then either sees the corresponding real key or a randomly sampled key. What does that mean? What is the security guarantee that we want to have? Intuitively,
that he can't distinguish between, like, which keys are right, so he can't quickly get him a ciphertext. This supposed key, he can't do something to verify that it's right, so just get no information out of it.
Exactly. So there is no information that distinguishes a real key from a random key. A real key must always look random. But, and so this is important to remember. IND CPA security means the attacker either sees a real key or a random key plus the ciphertext of the real key, which means that keys must look random. Okay, now back to the original question. Why do we need this function H? Why is that relevant, or what property does that achieve? It's not super easy to see. So let's write down, first of all, what we call it. So this function is sometimes called smoothing function. It smooths g to the xy because group elements don't look like random strings. Still, they have enough entropy. So choices of H can be a key derivation function or simpler, but not instantiable. The random oracle, which is instantiated in practice with hash functions. So why don't group elements look like random strings? For this, think of the first bit after computing modular reduction with prime p, e.g. p equals 1001 and so on. So we said, and this is given by the DDH, assumption, decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption, that g to the xy is indistinguishable from a random group element, which basically means, roughly speaking, that g to the xy, which is the result that is input here to the hash function, g to the xy is some random group element. But if this here is our prime, and we use it to modulo reduce the result of pk to the y, then there are much more elements that start with 0, 1, something, than 1, 0, 0, 1, something. Does that make sense? So if we reduce pk to the y modulo p, then just due to the first most significant bits of the prime and the modulo reduction, there are more numbers that start with 1 something than, or 0, 1 something, then 1, 0, 0, 1 something. And that means if we see a string that starts with 0, 1, something, then it is likely a real key output by pk to the y. Instead, if we sample a random number of that length here, it is equally likely that this random string starts with a 1 and a 0. For that reason, we input the result of pk to the y, into a function that basically smooths the entropy throughout all the bits of our key. Okay. Other questions? Somebody unhappy?
Does that mean that the exponentiation operator seen through modulo does not distribute evenly?
Yes, basically that is what I want.
Observable somehow?
It depends on your choice of the prime. Of course, if you have a prime that starts with a lot of ones at the beginning, then this is not a problem. But if you have a prime that is structured like that, then you have a problem. And since we want to have security for all the DH instantiations, for which also those type of primes can be valuable, the solution is that we put the result of pk to the y modulo p into such a smoothing function that then just distributes the randomness across all the bits that are output. Okay, so the security of the Eiger-Markham is that it is INDCPA secure. under the DDH assumption. The typical way of proving security for this would always be, and this is our typical recipe, option one, option A. A sequence of games. Just as a repetition, how would such a sequence of games look for this type of proof? So the initial game, game zero, is basically always the original game. Which is INDCPA for our Elgamalken. So if we want to use DDH, what does that give us? What would we do? Anybody remember what the DDH assumption or the DDH problem tells us? Decisional Diffie-Hellman. Not really. Almost. But just related to it, not the same. Yes?
Given X, Y, and Z, or Z, the attacker is either given G to the power of X times Y, or G to the power of Z, or Z, and he has to decide which one.
So, exactly. So the attacker, looking at our construction again, we see what these things are. So the attacker is given in DDH, the attacker is given G to the X, G to the Y, and then some third group element. And this third group element is either a random group element G to the Z for some random exponent Z, or it is G to the XY. So using that for proving that the Elgamalken is secure would be replacing in our first game hop of the sequence of games, replace G to the XY, which is PK to the Y, which is the same as C. Wait. C to the SK. With G to the Z, in the computation, of the key. The result of that is that if in our simulation of the challenge oracle, we replace this G to the XY with some random G to the Z, this means that the key that we compute here, is independent from the ciphertext and from the public key. So our key here is just H applied on some random group element. And as long as a random group element input to the smoothing function just outputs a random looking key, then we're good. Then this key is indistinguishable from a random key. Resulting key h of g to the z is independent of pk and c, and indistinguishable from random key. Option B is just to write down a direct reduction and the direct reduction on the left side has some DDH challenger, which is parameterized by the group generator and the prime and some bit B, and it's samples some x, y, and c exponents from zp prime. It computes z0 as g to the xy and z1 as g to the z. And we specify z star as ZB. Then we have our reduction in the middle. And our reduction receives as inputs G to the X, G to the Y, and Z star. And our reduction on the right side interacts with an adversary that tries to break the IND CPA security of the chem. For this, this adversary initially receives the public key, then queries the challenge oracle, it receives some ciphertext and some key, and this key is either real or random, and at the end the attacker guesses whether it either saw a real or random key, and we as the reduction eventually also provide a guess whether we saw the real g to the xy or a random g to the z. Now, the information that we provide to the attacker is just specified according to our construction. So the public key is specified as g to the x. The challenge ciphertext is specified as g to the y. And the challenge key is specified as h of z star. And we can just forward the guess from the adversary to our DDH challenger which then gives us the advantage term of breaking the chem in the IND CPA security game for some adversary C, A, is less equal the advantage of an adversary breaking the DDH game for some group specified by the generator and the prime. For smoothing function H. And this is a bit sloppy, but the main point is the idea. Now we have saved a little bit of time in the last week before Christmas, because we wrote down what the Al-Gamal scheme already looks like. And this gives me the opportunity to quickly show you how this boxes and arrows notation of a reduction would look like in pseudocode. So everything that comes now is fully redundant, it's just a different type of notation. So in pseudocode, this looks as follows. We have a reduction that gets us input x, y, and z star. This reduction specifies the public key as the capital X. And it provides an oracle challenge to the adversary. Now we leave one line blank here, which we will fill later. And we specify the ciphertext, just as in the prior reduction and above, as the capital Y. And we specify the key as H of Z star. We leave some blank space here, which we will fill in a second. And we return to the adversary challenge ciphertext and the challenge key. Now the attacker can query this oracle and eventually return a guess. Adversary gets as initial input the public key, and we stop with this guess of the adversary. Okay, so these two notations equally describe what a reduction does. The reduction specifies the initial input to the adversary. It offers some oracles, in this case just a challenge oracle. And the reduction does something to the output and eventually terminates. Something that is a bit lost in this intuitive specification of these boxes and arrows is that in some cases we want to give the adversary the option to query the challenge oracle multiple times. I typically just ignore this in these boxes and arrows notation. But as soon as we have this pseudocode here, we have to define whether we want to have one or multiple challenges. So one option is that we just allow the attacker just to query the challenge oracle once. But I wanted to show you a very simple trick of how to use a single challenge from our DDH challenger to produce multiple challenges for the Elgamal camp. Does anybody have an idea of how to do that? The property that DDH has, or this type of producing multiple challenges from a single one, in this particular case, is called random self-reducibility. So we can use one challenge, produce multiple challenges from that, and the solution for that still basically reduces to the single challenge that we had to solve. So what could we do in order to produce a second challenge or multiple challenges? What we can do is we sample another exponent y prime from zp star and we raise our capital Y to y prime. And we do the same for our key. The result is that the ciphertext is now g to the y times y prime, and the key is now h of the public key to the y times y prime. And this is exactly g to the x times y times y prime. So we basically randomize both the ciphertext and the key proportionately such that the attacker always sees either real or random keys slash ciphertexts. Okay, this was everything that I wanted to talk about regarding Elgamal. And this final multi-challenge creation is just an interesting side note. What was most important for me to show you is that there are different styles of writing down a reduction. As I said, one can write down a reduction like that, and this is perfectly fine for me. One can also write down the pseudocode, which can provide less intuition, but is, of course, more precise. Okay. From that, we continue with the RSA cam. Which was first published in Communications of the ACM in 1978. And you can find more information in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 447 and following. Without any further delay, we will just directly start looking at how the construction works. The key generation is just the same as in our signature scheme, RSA full domain hash. With the result that the decryption key or the secret key is some modulo n, which is the product of primes P and Q, and some value D, some exponent D, which is basically the decryption exponent. The public key also contains the modulo n and the inverse of the decryption exponent, which is E. The encapsulation takes as input the public key, just as for the AlgamalChem. We start with splitting the public key into its two components, N and E. Then we randomly sample an exponent, a value R from Z and star. We compute the key as H of R. And here H is a random oracle. And the ciphertext is R to the E mod N. So if you have ever seen the RSA public key encryption scheme, what we do, at least in the textbook variant, so in the simplest insecure variant, we basically encrypt R with the exponent E mod N in the ciphertext. So R is basically the source of our key material, and then we use R as the input to the random oracle to output the key. Eventually, we return K, C, and our decapsulation algorithm on input of the secret key and the ciphertext again parses the secret key as N, D. It decrypts the ciphertext by computing C to the D mod N, which yields R. And then we simply return H of R, which is the key. So, in practice, this is not really relevant anymore, because in practice it still is. So RSA is still used on billions of devices. But if you want to, I hope that if you start working for a company and want to implement something, then you will hopefully not use RSA anymore, because it's super inefficient. And there are many, many other problems about RSA. Nevertheless, we see that the security guarantees of this construction are pretty strong. So the RSA chem is IND CCA secure. If the RSA problem is hard, and we use the random oracle. So in the random oracle model. Important to note is that the security is strictly related to the fact that the message that we encrypt here, so the R that we encrypt here, is random. So this is important to note. If R is a non-random message, a secure encoding is necessary. Examples for that are PKCS 1 or OAEP. Another note is that El-Gamal is far more efficient and less fragile. Very important attack to be noted here is the so-called Bleichenbacher attack from Crypto 98, which breaks bad implementations of PKCS1. And there are some intuitive relations of the Bleichenbacher attack to the padding oracle attack from Vaudenay against CBC, the CBC block mode of operation for symmetric encryption. Basic idea is, again, that by observing the decryption with some badly implemented PKCS1 implementations, one can learn information about other messages, roughly speaking. So Bleichenbacher attack is important, but it's a little bit too complicated and we only have limited time, so we won't cover it here. But important to note, there have been multiple iterations of different forms of Bleichenbacher attacks in the last 28 years since the Bleichenbacher attack has been found. So I'm not sure who is part of the seminar with us this semester, but those of you who have been part, no, this was last semester in the seminar, there was a seminar about the history of the different Bleichenbacher attacks and how it evolved and why it is still available. The basic conclusion on my perspective, or in my perspective, is that PKCS1 is pretty hard to implement correctly and securely. Okay, this was everything that I wanted to talk about regarding RSA, which now brings me to the Fujisaki Okamoto transform. 3. Fujisaki Okamoto transform published at Crypto in 1999. Okay. Why is this relevant? So what are we doing here? The question that we are asking is how to build INDCCA secure CAM from an IND CPA, secure public key encryption scheme, Gen Eng and DAG prime. So we only have an IND CPA secure public key encryption scheme. We want to build something that is stronger, which is secure against chosen ciphertext attacks. So why is that relevant, first of all? It is relevant because, for example, the AlgamalChem that we have seen above is only secure against chosen plaintext attacks. So we want to build something that is secure against chosen ciphertext attacks. Another reason why this is relevant becomes visible when we look at this last part about hybrid public key encryption from the last week before Christmas. We have seen that hybrid public key encryption, which is basically the composition of a chem that encapsulates a key, and the symmetric encryption that uses that key to encrypt a message to overall build public key encryption, offers the following security guarantees. So we remember, if we have a chem that is IND CPA secure and we have a symmetric encryption scheme that is IND CPA secure, then we come up with a public key encryption scheme that is IND CPA secure. So we basically just preserve the security guarantees from the chem and the symmetric encryption scheme to the public key encryption scheme. But we so far don't have a way to strengthen the security from CPA to CCA security. But as soon as we have CCA security, so if we have a chem that is IND CCA secure and symmetric encryption scheme that is IND CCA secure, then also the public key encryption scheme is IND CCA secure. So the only piece that is missing for getting something that is strongly secure for practice is to come from here to here. The way that we do that is that we start here, here, together with that we build this. So from CPA secure, chem and symmetric encryption scheme, we build a public key encryption scheme. And now we learn how to use this to build this. So how to use an IND CPA secure public key encryption scheme to build an IND CCA secure chem. Because as soon as we have that, and we already know how to build IND CCA secure symmetric encryption, then we actually have a public key encryption scheme that is IND CCA secure. So, weak security, strong security, what we learn now is how to come from here to here. Questions about this motivation? This is important. This is simple but important. Okay, so how do we do that? So, Fuchizaki Okamoto transform how to build IND CCA secure chem from IND CPA secure public key encryption. Or to rephrase it a little bit, how to prevent malleability. So the ability of an attacker to modify ciphertexts in a still meaningful way. So how do we do that? So we start with the Gen algorithm. So the Gen algorithm of the IND CCA chem that we build based on the IND CPA public key encryption scheme. We first generate a secret key and a public key with our public key encryption scheme. Nice. Next step, we sample some random string S of length L. And L is some parameter, not very important for now. Then the decryption key is the secret key of the underlying public key encryption scheme. the random string s and the public key, and we return the secret key and the public key. The encapsulation using the public key works as follows. We sample a random message from the message space of the public key encryption scheme. Then we evaluate some random oracle H on input of the public key and that message. And the output is the key that we encapsulate plus some randomness. And this randomness is now used to de-randomize the encryption with the public key encryption scheme. So we encrypt with the public key encryption scheme the message M, and we specify the randomness that is used as the random vector output from the random oracle. And then we return K, C as the output of the encryption. So far there is very little magic. Nothing, almost nothing happened. We prepared some random string S. We encrypt a random message. And the interesting part here is we specify the randomness of our encryption algorithm to some fixed value R that is derived from the public key as input and the random message that we just sampled. The next step is the interesting trick. So what we wanted to do is to prevent malleability. We wanted to make sure. What is it?
The second argument on.
Yeah. This is a semicolon. Semicolon and then R.
But the R,
does that come from? From here. It's the output of a hash function.
Okay.
So it's the output of a random oracle, which we would instantiate as a hash function. And the input here is PK and this random M. Now shortly wake up. If we want to prove security regarding INDCCA security, reminder, INDCCA security, the attacker additionally has a decryption oracle. So if we want to prove security regarding INDCCA security, so we are the reduction, our attacker wants to have a decryption oracle, but we, as the reduction, only have access to a challenge oracle. So we don't have a decryption oracle. We still have to simulate. So the big question is, how can we make life easy for us such that we can simulate the decryption oracle to our attacker without having one from our challenger? This is the tricky question, and we will now see in the decryption algorithm how this is done. So, decryption algorithm takes as input the secret key and the ciphertext, starts with parsing the secret key as its components, SK prime, S, and the public key. And then we just start with what would be expected, which is decrypting the message with the decryption algorithm of the public key encryption scheme. So far, no surprise. The interesting part starts now. we compute k, r with our random oracle on input of the public key and the message m prime. So far, we just inverted what has been done before. We first encrypted the message, now we decrypt the message, and then we previously first took the public key and the message as input to a random oracle. The output was K and R, and we just do the same here. So we have the public key as part of the secret key, we take the message that we just decrypted, and we compute the same values. Then we do something more, which is not super relevant for now, which we will add in a couple of seconds. The interesting trick is now that we re-encrypt. The message. So we decrypted the message first, derived the relevant values, and now we just do the same again. We re-encrypt with our own public key, the randomness that we derived from the random oracle, and the message that we decrypted before. And the idea is that we now check if either the message decryption was not successful, or the ciphertext as input to the decryption differs from our own re-encryption, then something failed. We will add what failed in a second, and otherwise we just return the key as output from the hash function, from the random oracle. So this is the core idea. And what is the core idea? Again, everybody wake up. We first decrypt, and then we verify if this decryption actually corresponds to a valid encryption. So we decrypt the message, and then we check if this, in the same way, could have been done on the encryption side. And the idea is that we use the tricks of the random oracle to simulate and to verify, to observe what types of inputs and outputs have been seen here, in order to be sure that an attacker can only create a ciphertext that is valid if the random oracle was used. So what was the initial question? How do we simulate a decryption oracle if we don't have one? So we have to simulate one, but we can't use one from our challenger. And the idea is we use the random oracle to observe whether the adversary ever produced a valid looking ciphertext. If this is the case, then we can produce it the same way, because we observe everything that happens with the random oracle. We can basically return what the adversary saw as well. If the attacker didn't use the random oracle, then it is practically impossible that the attacker produced a valid looking ciphertext. And for that reason, we can just reject it. The way we reject it is to just use another random oracle. So we produce a second key just for the case of rejection with another random oracle that takes as input the public key, the random string, and the ciphertext, and then we return this random key. The idea of this is that the attacker has no way of learning this secret string that we sampled and put into our secret key, and we just use this random string to produce random looking keys in the case that the attacker produced something that didn't look valid to us. So this is a bit complex. Look at it for a second. Think about it for a second, and then I will write down the proof idea. As a reminder, the proof ideas. Big question is how to simulate the decapsulation oracle. To encapsulate a symmetric key to someone else, such that the key stays confidential to everybody except for the receiver. And confidential meaning that the key should look random, even if the adversary knows the ciphertext and the public key.
And if we return K prime, the other peer doesn't know.
So, the idea of ever outputting K prime is that this situation does not happen for valid ciphertexts. It only happens for ciphertexts that were adversarially created. So, if I perform my encryption the way it is described here, so if I'm a valid sender, I am Alice, and I want to send something to Bob, then I will use this algorithm. And if I use this algorithm, I will sample a random message, input public key and message to the random oracle, output this key, and use this randomness to encrypt the message to the receiver. The receiver Bob will just invert these operations, first decrypting the message from the ciphertext. This is happening here. Then using the decrypted message to evaluate the hash function or the random oracle with the public key, so we have again key K and R. Then we re-encrypt this thing, so we again perform this operation here, and since the randomness stays the same, the message is valid, the message has just been decrypted, the public key is also valid, then the ciphertext will exactly be the same as the one that was input here. For that reason, I will never end up in this situation, I will always, as Bob, receive this key here. Only for ciphertexts for which that weren't validly created with this encryption algorithm, I can end up in this situation here. And for that reason, I don't care that an adversary that didn't use the right algorithm doesn't share the key with the receiver.
So the only purpose of K-prime is that the adversary doesn't see whether you constructed a real key or not.
The actual purpose is that if the attacker produces a ciphertext, the key that is output by the decryption algorithm looks independent from all the valid ones, especially from the challenges. That's the idea. So even if the attacker minimally changes the ciphertext, the result should always be that the attacker just sees a random key that is independent from real keys that have been produced by the challenge oracle.
What's the purpose of introducing H prime instead of H?
Theory. One could also just add a second context input or something like that. It's just the idea at the end is if you look at the paper, And so there have been many, many follow-up papers to the Fujisaki-Okamoto transform. Especially recently, when we talk about post-quantum security, there have been many proofs of variants of the Fujisaki-Okamoto transform. Some of them, instead of outputting some random key that is independent, just output a rejection symbol here. Some of them derive the key from an independent random oracle. The idea is that they provide different guarantees depending on what type of capabilities the attacker is given. This here, from my perspective, is the most standard form and the simplest form. You just execute those things. You always output a key, and everything goes as expected. But if you dig deeper into the literature, there are many variants that slightly differ from that. And then if you look at these papers, instead of saying that we have one random oracle and this random oracle as first input has input 0 or 1, we just call the one random oracle h, and the other one h prime. This is the same, yeah. Okay, so coming back to the proof idea. So h and h prime are random oracles. And this means for us as the reduction that we can observe the inputs and outputs of the random oracles. So the reduction observes inputs and outputs of H and H prime. This is good. So we see what has been input, what has been output, and especially if the attacker produces some ciphertext, we can typically just look at what the inputs and outputs of the random oracle were for producing a valid ciphertext. And in order to do that, the reduction keeps a list. Of all PK M prime R and K. For queries to H of PK M prime with output K and R. Now we come back to the question, how to simulate the decapsulation oracle. If C is queried to oracle decapsulate with input C, then we check if there exists some public key M prime R and K such that the encryption algorithm of our underlying public key encryption scheme on input of the public key, the message, and the fixed randomness R yields ciphertext C. If yes, then we simply return K as the output of the decapsulation oracle. This was a valid ciphertext. It was created using the random oracle. It was created such that the encryption actually outputs, based on these inputs, the right ciphertext. So we are happy. We just observed and saw a real looking ciphertext. If no, guessing correct output R for the random oracle on input M prime without querying the random oracle is highly unlikely. So to answer the question in a very, very simple single phrase, we built our encapsulation algorithm in a way such that building a valid ciphertext requires that the random oracle is queried and then an encryption with fixed randomness is executed. So as long as I know the inputs and outputs of the random oracle, I can check for all ciphertexts created so far, if they are valid or if they are not. Otherwise, it is hard to produce a valid-looking ciphertext. And for that reason, the reduction, without actually having access to a decryption oracle, can produce valid-looking outputs to the decryption oracle the reduction has to simulate itself. This is the idea of the Fujisaki-Okamoto transform. And now, to embed that into the broader context, this is practical. So, next week we will look at post-quantum, the idea of post-quantum key encapsulation mechanisms. And for all of the post-quantum, or for almost all of the post-quantum key encapsulation mechanisms, the requirement was just to provide an IND CPA secure instance. Because it is obvious that using the Fujisaki-Okamoto transform, we can turn them all into CCA secure schemes. So more or less, if you want to develop a new key encapsulation mechanism, it's not necessary to provide something that is CCA secure, because at the end, using the Fujisaki-Okamoto transform, you will end up with something that is secure. The only big drawback of the FO transform is that in the decapsulation, you first have to decapsulate, but then you have to re-encapsulate. So if decapsulation and encapsulation are expensive, then you probably would like to avoid that you do both of these operations in the decapsulation. For that reason, it is still valuable to find more efficient variants than just applying the generic FO transform. But the generic FO transform is the default. Okay, so this was everything about generic chems and the two non-post-quantum secure chems. I will now motivate why we need post-quantum secure constructions if we fear that quantum adversaries are realistic in the future. So everybody who has seen Shor's algorithm before, we won't go very deep into the details, we will just understand the rough idea. So Shor's algorithm and the power of quantum adversaries, and you can take a look at Katz-Lindell book on pages 497 and following. Shor's algorithm finds periods for inputs to function f. So what does that mean? If function f on input A is the same as function f on input A plus delta, then delta is the period. That means the Shor's algorithm on input of function f outputs delta. So this is on a very, very, very high level of what Shor's algorithm gives us. How is this useful for breaking the constructions that we have seen before? And we will just look at the discrete logarithm problem, which is underlying the DDH problem, which then breaks the Al-Gamal chem. The application to RSA is similar. So for discrete logarithm, x of h, which is defined as g to the x, we define the function as follows. So f parameterized by g and h on input a1 and a2 is defined as g to the a1 times h to the minus a2. So, if this is the function and we input this function parameterized with g and h, to Shor, it will give us the discrete logarithm. Let's now see why this is true. So for f of g and h, we have that delta equals x comma 1. So x is the discrete logarithm that we want to find out. So delta includes the discrete logarithm that we want to find out. And delta is the thing that Shor's algorithm gives us. So why is this true? F of g and h on input of a1 plus x comma a2 plus 1 is the same as g to the a1 plus x times h to the minus a2 plus 1. This is the same as g to the a1 times g to the x times h to the minus h2, a2 times h to the minus 1. This is the same as g to the a1 times g to the x times h to the minus a2 times g to the minus x. This is true because h equals g to the x. And now the result is that we have g to the a1 times h to the minus a2. And this is how our function is defined. So x and 1 is indeed the period of this function that we just specified. And the result is that Shor of f defined for g and h indeed outputs x and 1, where g to the x equals h, and this solves the discrete logarithm. As I mentioned before, final remarks. A similar approach works for RSA. And there is a second algorithm that must be mentioned in this context, which is Grover's algorithm. But I will talk about this in a second, after you stopped taking notes. So Grover's algorithm only reduces security of symmetric key or symmetric assumptions. Let's call it symmetric key primitives. By reducing the security level by a factor of 1/2. And this means it is sufficient for those symmetric key primitives to just double the key length. So if 128 bits was sufficient before, we should now use 256 bits. And if 256 bits was sufficient before, we should use 512 bits, and so on. So for symmetric key primitives, like symmetric encryption, message authentication codes, hash functions, and so on, it is sufficient to just double the key length. But for asymmetric primitives, especially those that are based on the discrete logarithm or the RSA problem, Shor's algorithm breaks them. Relatively efficient with relatively few qubits, but so far we are very far from efficient algorithm executions and very far away from scaling qubits fast enough. For that reason, this is still the future. But if we want to protect secrets today that stay secret for a longer time than 20 years, then people keep saying since 15 years that in 10 years they will not be secure anymore. So far, the breakthrough hasn't been coming, but of course, breakthroughs sometimes happen very quickly. For that reason, it makes sense to consider Shor's algorithm a threat against public key crypto. And for that reason, next week we will see each other back again and try to understand how post-quantum secure chems can be built. Thank you so much for your attention. And one final note, maybe also still on the record, I'd be super happy if you submit your evaluations, because evaluations, especially for young teachers, young professors, are very valuable. So first of all, of course, if you have feedback, I'd be happy to receive it, especially if it was somewhat successful to adapt my style of teaching based on your intermediate feedback. But also, in any case, all feedback is valuable. Thank you so much, and that would be very appreciated. Bye.